In the frigid Chicago winter of 1927, the blues isn't just music, it's testimony. On the city's south side, where Model T Fords share potholed streets with horse-drawn wagons and gangsters cruise past dandies, Ma Rainey arrives for a recording session that will become a battlefield. The mother of the blues understands something fundamental. Her voice sells records to black audiences across America, giving her rare leverage in a white-dominated industry. When she finally arrives, deliberately 2 hours late, the power dynamics crackle like electricity. The white producers need her voice on wax, but Ma knows they want to package and sell her culture without understanding its soul. "We're doing this song in the old way," she insists when her manager suggests using trumpeter Levy's jazzier arrangement. "And my nephew Sylvester is doing the introduction." When they protest his stutter, her response cuts through pretense. "Damn what you thought. What you look like telling me how to sing my song." Each demand, from her specific brand of Coca-Cola to proper heating, becomes an act of resistance, small rebellions against a system designed to extract black creativity while dismissing black humanity. The cramped band room becomes a pressure cooker, where four musicians, Levy, Toledo, Cutler, and Slow Drag, await Ma's arrival. Their conversations reveal the complex strategies black Americans developed to navigate a hostile world. Toledo philosophizes about collective advancement. Cutler finds strength in faith. Slow Drag remains detached, while ambitious trumpeter Levy dreams of forming his own band with modern arrangements. These conflicting survival approaches create friction. When Levy boasts about knowing how to handle white men, the others mock his seeming subservience. "I can smile and say yes, sir, to whoever I please," Levy retorts. "I got my time coming." The confined space amplifies every disagreement until differences become dangerous. Each man carries scars from America's racial violence, creating a shared trauma language that both unites and divides them. What begins as professional rivalry between Ma's traditional blues and Levy's forward-looking jazz evolves into a deeper debate about how black art and lives can exist with dignity in a system designed for their exploitation. The band room transforms into a confessional when Levy reveals his defining childhood trauma. At 8, he witnessed white men break into his home and assault his mother. His attempt to defend her earned him a chest scar, a permanent physical and psychological wound. Levy's father initially seemed to accept the violation, even selling land to the attackers. But this was strategy. After sending his family north to safety, he returned to kill 4 attackers before being caught, hanged, and burned. This revelation reframes Levy's character. His accommodating attitude toward white producers isn't subservience, but a mask concealing deeper ambitions. Like his father, Levy has learned to smile while plotting his own course, a survival strategy written in blood. The band's reactions, Slow Drag's somber bass playing, Toledo's knowing nod, Cutler's distant stare, reveal their own carried burdens. These collective traumas find expression in their interactions and in the blues they create, serving as both testimony to suffering and means of processing it. "God don't mean nothing to me," Levy declares, igniting the play's most explosive confrontation. When Cutler shares the story of Reverend Gates, a black preacher who maintained dignity through prayer despite white humiliation, Levy erupts in fury, seeing delusion rather than strength in religious devotion. "Your God ain't shit," he tells Cutler, recalling his mother's unanswered prayers during her assault. The theological dispute turns physical when Levy pulls his knife, challenging Cutler's God to intervene. "Strike me down before I cut his throat." His rage, "Did you turn your back, motherfucker?" reveals deep spiritual wounds. This confrontation exposes faith as both solace and source of conflict. For Cutler, Christianity provides dignity despite oppression. For Levy, the contradiction between religious promises and lived experience creates an irreconcilable crisis. These weren't abstract theological debates, but urgent matters of psychological survival, reflecting broader debates within Black America about divine justice and faith's role in liberation.
$5? Levy stares in disbelief at Sturdivant's offer for his original compositions. He's pinned his hopes on the producer's promise to record his songs for income, artistic validation, and independence. When Sturdivant dismisses these songs as not the type we're looking for, the betrayal cuts deep. This transaction exposes the music industry's dishonesty. Sturdivant never intended to promote Levy, but was merely acquiring potential material cheaply. The paltry sum, which Levy throws away in disgust, quantifies how little value the industry placed on Black creativity outside its commercial exploitation. Ma Rainey demonstrates her understanding when she demands payment for her nephew Sylvester's contribution. "One more mistake, and I can make my record someplace else," she threatens when Sturdivant resists. Ma knows her leverage exists within narrow parameters and must be used strategically. Each concession erodes both her economic position and dignity. This economic structure explains why many Black musicians died in poverty despite creating valuable cultural works. The system extracted maximum profit while returning minimum compensation.
Toledo accidentally steps on Levy's new yellow shoes, a seemingly minor incident that triggers the play's devastating conclusion. In a moment of displaced fury, Levy fatally stabs Toledo, killing the band's philosopher and friend. This violence emerges from accumulated frustrations, finding expression in misdirected rage. The trigger seems disproportionate, but merely provides the spark for an explosion fueled by deeper grievances. Levy has just experienced the crushing of his musical ambitions by Sturdivant, the latest in a lifetime of racial injustices. Unable to direct his rage at its true target, the white power structure that has repeatedly denied his humanity, Levy redirects it toward the nearest person. Toledo becomes the recipient of flurry meant for Sturdivant, for his mother's assailants, for a society that consistently thwarts Black ambition. The tragedy lies in its inevitability. Throughout the play, Levy's frustrations mount with no healthy release valve, ultimately destroying not the oppressor, but another victim of the same system.
As the lights fade, Levy's trumpet lingers, blowing pain and warning across generations. This final image transforms personal tragedy into universal testimony, incorporating it into the ongoing narrative of Black experience in America. What remains is the blues itself, a repository of collective memory and tool of resistance. When Ma explains, "White folks don't understand about the blues, they hear it come out, but they don't know how it got there," she articulates how this music contains coded knowledge inaccessible to outsiders. The recording studio setting adds another dimension, transforming ephemeral expression into permanent form while preserving voices that might otherwise be silenced. In a world determined to deny Black humanity, creating and preserving Black art becomes an essential act of self-determination. The blues that breathes and touches speaks across decades as testimony, resistance, and memory. Through Ma Rainey and her band, we witness how art created from suffering becomes both shield and weapon in the ongoing struggle for dignity.